Aidan Locke, President and CEO of Marimaca Copper. We're developing the Marimaca Oxide Project in northern Chile and currently focusing back on the original value creation strategy, which is around exploration, and we've got some amazing new projects in the pipeline.
Great. We'll come on to the blue sky exploration upside in a second. I want to talk about how businesses like yours advance through to some kind of exit, some kind of value, whether that be getting into production or getting interested parties to come on board and build this thing for you. So where are we today?
Yeah, we're in that boring but necessary phase of, as you call it, project execution. In our view, regardless of which way you end up going in terms of, you know, being acquired or, you know, going through to production, you have to be clear that you're intending to build this project, which is exactly what we are. So right now we're focused on the permitting side, which is all important. As we know, in the mining industry, there are a lot of great projects that fail on the permitting side. So we're giving that a huge amount of attention. We're looking to submit that in the middle of the year, which will then give us a clear timeline as to when we can start construction. And then the second piece of the puzzle is delivering the DFS towards the end of the year, updated CapEx, updated OpEx, updated financial model to underpin the value of this project, but also, more importantly, allow us to go and really have detailed discussions around debt financing.
Right, and talk to you about the DFS component, because again, when we've kind of looked at companies over the past 2 or 3 years, there are DFSs and there are DFSs, right? So some are built to be pretty for the market and some are because the company intends to actually get this thing into production themselves. Can you build this as a standalone and can you deliver it?
Yeah, that's one of the great things about this project is it's a financeable project from a CapEx perspective. But it is also, in terms of execution risk and general project risk, I've said it multiple times, its location, shallow, open pit, low strip ratio, very good metallurgy in an amazing location means on the risk spectrum, it is at the lower end of the risk spectrum. So absolutely, we can build this as a standalone company. Do we have the capabilities today to build it? Probably not, but that's why we're starting the process of building out our team and our internal processes and understanding who we're going to partner with, how we're going to execute. But absolutely, this is a project we would like to build.
Okay. And I think, you know, looking back to the last 2 years, I mean, we've learned lessons as investors, and I'm interested to see what lessons you've learned, because companies, I guess the normal rules didn't apply. And, you know, building value was much harder in that market. I mean, copper wasn't really responding. It wasn't doing bad, but it wasn't really kind of responding to, you know, the kind of supply demand fundamentals. Equities definitely weren't performing. So, That kind of navigating around those deliverables to get you to where you are today. I mean, can you look back and say, well, I wish we'd done some things differently, or I think actually maybe we got a 10 out of 10 there in terms of execution. Give us a sense of how you feel about it.
I think probably the thing that I would look back and say I'd like to have changed is I'd like to have gone more aggressively and more quickly towards becoming a producer than we did. There was some uncertainty. You know, as you say, the copper price didn't respond. I think we all believed that the EV and the new transition to a low carbon economy was going to completely dwarf the traditional Dr. Copper demand drivers. When the reality is that global inflation and global synchronized raising of interest rates did have a dampening impact on the copper price, especially on speculation on the copper price. What I should have said to myself back then was have confidence that the long-term thematic is still completely intact and you need to go absolutely hell for leather to get this project into production because we would be significantly closer to doing that. As it happened, it was difficult to raise money. The price, the valuation vis-a-vis what we thought the intrinsic value of the project wasn't there. And so we didn't really want to raise a big lump of capital to then go and deliver all of this work stream. So I guess you could say we probably saved a bit of dilution, but in doing that, we certainly extended our timelines a little bit.
It's kind of interesting, actually, and it wouldn't be too hard on yourself. The amount of CEOs that come and talk to me, and then, you know, off record say, "I wish we hadn't burned through the." And so I'm going to talk about gold CEOs who say, "We wish we hadn't burned through our capital so quickly." But the expectation was in this environment, everything pointed to gold going on a rip. I mean, it has recently, but I think expectation it would have done 2 years ago, but they've kind of burnt through capital and put themselves in quite dangerous, you know, cash constrained positions now. So, like I say, wouldn't beat yourself up about that one. The bit you've still got to deliver on is obviously getting a DFS done is one part of the equation. You've got a better sense of the economics and I think there's a bit more stability around supply chains and pricing and capex and opex options for you. But you've still got to go and say to the market, look, we can get into production. We can do it in a timely fashion. We can do it within budget and possibly into a higher copper environment. Is anyone listening at the moment?
You know, certainly not for us. And I think it's I think there's a general consensus that Marimaca is an amazing copper development project. The challenge is getting that money to trickle into us at this stage. And we've just, you know, the copper price is on its air. We've barely moved, despite the fact that we're significantly further de-risked than we were 6-12 months ago. So it is a little bit difficult. And I think, look, we definitely need to not just talk about the fact that we're transitioning to become a producer. We need to actually show the market that we are transitioning. And that's what we're going to do over the next 6-12 months. We're looking at the next phase of financing, which is not about this year. It's about 2025, 2026, getting us to FID, building out our owners team, choosing the best partners, starting to really bring some coherency to that strategy. And, you know, okay, we've said it. We think that this project is executable. Now we need to actually put in place the pieces of that execution puzzle and show that to the market so that they believe us, that we're capable of doing it.
No, absolutely. But here's the thing. There's not a lot of copper companies, advanced stage copper companies, who are at DFS or even thinking about FID that we can fund. Lots of explorers, you know, going through the phases of trying to. But that lack of competition is an opportunity. It's also a liability in the sense that there's not a peers for bankers or investors to look at and go, it'll be okay because lots of people have done the same thing. So again, how do you manage that narrative?
Yeah, I think the scarcity premium of Marimaca is amazing. That I would say, there's not very many at all. That there are some really good projects, but they're of that mega scale where you definitely need a partner. And what we know about the major mining companies who would be the logical partner for these projects is they're a bit gun shy. They still want a higher copper price in order to green light a $1 billion investment. So we are, in that sense, a very unique project. I think a large part of that is getting the right people and the right partners in to really stand up and say, look, here is a group that we're partnering with that has the credibility to take this through to production. It's a large part of the reason that we partnered with Ausenco on our DFS. They recently came off the build of Mantoverde. They did that on a lump sum, fixed price, turnkey contract. You know, that's about to start producing. It's going to be a completely game-changing asset for Capstone. And so we've lifted the whole team that was involved in that. So we're starting to develop that. But I think there's an owner's team component to that where we have to have the key skills in-house. And we're starting to build that slowly. And then, you know, I've had the question several times, am I the right guy to be running this company? Maybe I'm not. Maybe we need a significantly more experienced mine-building CEO. So everything is on the table. What I care about is that this project goes from where we are today to copper in the shortest possible period.
And just in the Ausenco, very well known. You know, we talked to several development companies, and they're looking at Ausenco as a partner. The track record is fantastic. They're great to kind of give comfort to you because you feel that they know what they're doing. Do financiers understand who Ausenco is? What they are capable of? Does it? You know, how much does it sway their likelihood of actually funding this thing? Because again, I feel that maybe sometimes when you're in a space like this where there's not too many other kind of copper companies to look at, can you look to gold companies and say, well, it's effectively the same thing. As long as you believe the thematic is positive, it's effectively the same type of build. It's going to be okay. How do you get bankers like me over the line and feel comfortable?
Yeah, well, so Ausenco, in terms of recent copper builds in Latin America, they built Mina Justa, which is owned by a private consortium of Peruvian and Chilean companies. That was an oxide SXEW project into a sulfide flotation project, $1 billion worth of capex, executed flawlessly. You see, the Mantoverde flotation sulfide project is an enormous project, and they deliver it on time, on budget through COVID. So they do have a remarkable track record. And yes, bankers, in terms of debt financiers, are very aware of who Ausenco is. And they're really one example. There are multiple, there's not a huge array, but there are at least two or three groups that have that skill set that have built a lot of mines in Latin America recently. And we will certainly be talking to all of them in terms of how we position ourselves to give ourselves that credibility that we can execute.
Okay, so DFS by the end of this year, what's left to do?
Well, all of the engineering. So we're focused on the permitting at the moment, and there's so we're using Asenco for both. There is an engineering component to the permitting, that, and we want to get the permits in because that's the critical part of the project. You know, once we submit, it's about a 12-month process on the low side, up to a 2-year process on the high side to get our environmental approval, and then another, you know, probably 6 months to get the remaining approvals to build it. So that's the focus. In terms of the DFS, well, we've already done the sort of class 5 review of the project, which is really around, you know, what are we aiming to build this project for, and what's the art of the possible here? Being reasonable in terms of, you know, the comment that you made, which is a good one. We don't want to deliver a DFS where we're going to be laughed out of the room by the banks. And equally, you know, the well-informed investors in the world who will be able to pull that apart once we release our 43-101. But we equally don't want to let our CapEx slip, because that's one of the key advantages of this project, is that it is just so much lower absolute capital and capital intensity than just about every other copper development story. So it's very important to us. We have a rough idea. It's in line with what I was thinking it would be. I'm certainly, my internal objective is this project must be less than $500 million to build. And I do believe that that is still very much achievable. And I would hope would be closer to 400 than to 500 million, upfront capex to build this, which is, yeah, would make us the industry leading copper development play for a 50,000 ton a year copper producer.
Right. And if, again, slightly looking back and slightly looking forward in the sense that permits, environmental, and all of those wonderful things, social and et cetera, is that kind of like, and I say there's a context of time is money, right? Has that delayed things? How much more has that cost you? You know, were you sort of conscious of those factors being a big part of the solution when you first started looking at this thing? Are we 2.5 years in? I mean, when did you?
I joined 4 years ago. So obviously a lot's changed.
No, but since... actively, were you not? You were sort of there.
So I've been in the CEO role over 2 years, 3 years officially with the company, 4 years when you include my consultancy. Yeah. It's always been a focus, but I think probably the amount of work that we did to analyze this and develop the strategy for how we would permit it was probably increased as a result of some of the more high-profile permitting problems that occurred for some of our peers, and, you know, including Anglo American, might add, who were permitting Los Bronces and got turned down. It really sharpened our focus on the need to be exceptionally well prepared and to I guess, create more data and more reasons why this project will not be an environmental hazard and a social hazard, rather than being less prepared and just going for it gung-ho, which there are several projects that have been permitted recently in our region, and we think at least one of them wasn't as well prepared as they could have been, and that caused delays in their permitting process. So yes, the cost for us hasn't been so much dollar cost, but it has been a time cost in getting prepared. But obviously the value of doing that extra 6 months of preparation is that you might shorten your timeline by more than 12 months at the back end. So it makes sense from a net perspective to do that.
Right. And we've seen an Aussie company, you know, a peer of yours, they've actually just spun out a water project, or trying to spin out a water project, as a USP in the region. Is water for you guys is what? Is that problematic? Do you need to solve that problem?
So three years ago, we identified water and using particularly fresh water as a fatal flaw of the project. And so we did all of our MET testing using seawater, and we have now signed a water option agreement, and we've secured our supply of water for the life of the project. So no, we're one of the very few mining development projects that has virtually no water risk from a permitting perspective. Obviously we need to get that to our site, so we'll need to build a pipeline. But you know, in terms of our water risk profile, we are once again right at the bottom end of that risk spectrum.
Okay, and with obviously copper going on a rip, we'll say 450-ish at the moment. It was sort of bouncing around 370, 380 before Christmas. So it's only recent times, but if it sustains at this rate, at what point do equities start to take advantage of that higher copper price. Obviously, producers will, because they'll be receiving more cash. We've seen it happening in the gold space, lots of M&A happening as a result of that, backfilling their reserve numbers. For copper, there's a lot of private companies, not a lot of public producers out there. How does that affect your ability to kind of capture some of that increased value environment as a developer, public market developer? Will you be able to see any of that benefit?
Yeah, there will be eventual trickle down. But I think, when you think about it from an investor perspective, the sudden run up in copper price, obviously the first thing that gets bought and bought strongly is the producers, because you can very clearly see the benefit of that copper price coming through in their cash flows. So, I don't know exactly how much Capstone is appreciated as an example, but I think it's probably 40 or 50%, in the last little while on the back of that strong copper price influence. So they're already seeing it in the producers. And those highly levered names that have, relatively high cost copper projects, the sudden expansion of their cash flow will have a very strong impact on their share price. And that will naturally trickle down once the alpha in those trades is gone. So once investors start to realize they can no longer make that alpha, unless they're underwriting a $5 copper price, which maybe they are, they need to start looking in the zones that haven't moved. And that's really the developer phase, of which the cupboards are bare. So eventually that will get to us. The challenge we have, as we've always said, is a lack of liquidity and a lack of ability for institutional investors to buy our shares in any meaningful way. But if the copper price continues to move, then there will, I'm sure, be a sudden change in their risk appetite to buy us, especially if we haven't moved, which we really haven't. I mean, copper price has gone up significantly and we've barely moved, despite the fact that we've significantly moved our project along from a technical de-risking perspective.
Yeah, if you've got the intent to kind of build this thing out, or at least say, well, this is a nice standalone project and we think we can build the company out to take advantage of that, don't you focus on that? Why talk to me about exploration, which I'm sure you're going to talk to me about in a second? Why does that add value? Why is it more likely to add value or be perceived to be more valuable by shareholders, by the broader market? Why not get this thing closer to production? Because it's all about money, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. So we continue to focus 90% of our attention on moving the project forward, and that's very much our focus. And a very clear message from Mitsubishi Corp as our partner is, we don't want you to lose focus on moving the project forward. But equally, we have an amazing exploration team in Sergio Paola, who are avowed explorationists. And as we develop the project, project geology is very different to exploration. So we're transitioning the geology side to our project geologists, which leaves Sergio and his team not completely busy, because they're always out doing things, looking for new, but certainly without, they're not fully utilized. We don't want to lose that IP. I would say I wouldn't go out and start doing pure greenfields exploration at this stage, but where there is an interesting, I think, on the balance of probabilities, higher chance of exploration success, as we think there is at Sierra de Medina, as we certainly think there is at Mercedes, which is just to the north of Marimaca, then we perceive for relatively little dollars relative to our market cap and relative to what we're spending on the project, that we could potentially materially improve the value of the whole Marimaca portfolio. So really, we're either looking for, in the case of Sierra de Medina, the very large prize, like a new Mantos Blancos or Cachorro, which is several hundred million tons at north of 1% copper. So something that is game-changing and could dwarf Marimaca. And then in the case of Mercedes, it's really a highly complementary exploration target, which is shallow oxide. It's already proven that the shallow oxide's there. The key now is, can we make that meaningful that extends Marimaca's mine life from, what are we now, 15, 16 years, depending on if we include all of the resource measured, indicated, and inferred, to 20, 25 years plus of oxide production. That is incredibly valuable for our shareholders. It's not going to distract us from the focus, which is moving Marimaca to production, but it just creates more reasons for new investors to come in and invest in the number one development asset, as we see it, the certainly the shortest timeline, but with an enormous amount of upside attaching to it. I'm sure everyone refers to the Lasson curve. I think everyone knows this is a boring time for a company as we do what is necessary to get to production. If there is a non-greenfields exploration opportunity that adds value to that, that's not going to cost us too much money, we'll always pursue it.
Okay, so you and Lasson will advance towards that DFS by the end of this year, after which, I guess, you know, what we'd be looking for is some kind of indication from you guys as to how, what's this kind of so what element. Okay, so we've got this definitive feasibility study. We've got to get to FID or start a beauty parade, where you start looking at maybe, you know, other strategic partners to come in and maybe take this forward for you. Because, as I say, you're kind of set up as a explore code developer, and you'd have to maybe bring the right skill sets in, presumably, right, to build this thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're talking right now about how do we finance the next phase of development, which will be bringing in those skills, expanding the team, making sure we've got all the right skills and processes in place to transition to a production company. So we're, you know, there's a lot of interest right now in copper. And as I've said previously, I think for the first time in my career in mining, I'm probably the least of my concerns is whether or not be able to finance this. The bigger question is, how do we continue to not lose time on our timelines and then find the right partner to come in that's going to add value to us, that's going to be supportive, that's going to bring with it some additional credibility that allows us to get to production.
Brilliant. So, look, we'll hear more about it, I guess, as you progress and advance things. As boring as it may seem, I think it's important for people to understand that you're capable, you're not financially constrained, you're able to get to, well, I think for most people, think DFS is right, we're done and dusted now, you know. And so I think the expectation is that that's when things will start picking up for you. I suspect it will probably also be with an announcement of how you finance into 2025, but we'll come back to that later. The market is really super, super interesting. It's been super interesting because the market has not behaved the way people thought it would behave. Certainly the precious metal guys would argue that. It's super interesting that very little action has been happening for the past 2.5 years with the equities, with the notable exception of, I think, lithium for a short burst from the end of 22 till towards the end of 2023. Uranium potentially as well as you know, been on a tear and obviously come back, reset of recent months as well, taking a breather there. But when you're going and having these conversations with the copper industry, the big players in copper, whether that be the producers as potential partners or acquisitors, the battery boys and girls, the OEMs, etc. What's the feedback that you're getting? Because we've seen a lot of, say, battery manufacturers, OEMs, like move upstream just to try and secure those metals. What gives you hope? And you know, can you share some of that insight with us?
Yeah, we've also seen OEMs, which I was personally very surprised about, wanting to talk to us about trying to, you know, secure, make an investment to secure some sort of offtake of copper, and particularly copper cathode. So that's been a surprising nuance. I had always thought that they would be looking at it from a nickel perspective, for their battery manufacturing, but less so copper, which is much more easily tradable. But I think there is the consensus and the view that copper is in an amazing position in the medium to long term is very much clear amongst every participant that we speak to. I think you know, there are plenty of projects in the pipeline, but nobody's willing to green light them at this copper price. And so there will not be a supply response until the copper price goes meaningfully higher. And even when it does go meaningfully higher and people green light projects, it's still going to be several years before many of these projects can even reach first production. So the medium to long term thematic is strong. I think I mentioned briefly that, you know, the original old market demand side of copper is still the dominant force. Although we're transitioning to this electrified economy and low carbon economy, and that will become very important in the next 10 years, I think, the original demand drivers are still very important. And so therefore, global economic growth and having confidence in the economic growth cycle is still very important for copper. I think this run-up in copper has really been built upon two things. Despite the issues going on in China, the very well-documented property issues that have been going on in China, Chinese demand for copper is at record highs. So they're importing record amount of concentrate, record amount of cathode. It's there. So it's going somewhere in the industry. Now, I think what people are overlooking is China is the leader, the global leader in investment in renewable energy generation. So last year, 150% growth in renewable energy investment. They dwarfed every other economy. This year, solar alone is up 50%. Wind is up 39%. Already just in this part of the year, it's up 39%. So they'll probably be close to 100% growth in generation capacity again this year. But what's really, really, really interesting is the amount of money being spent on the transmission and distribution infrastructure in China. So the broad scale transmission infrastructure takes a little bit of copper. The further down into the local level of transmission that you go, the more copper is demanded per megawatt of energy delivered. And China is going aggressively because they realize, which the Western economies haven't realized, that the transmission grid is not capable of delivering the amount of energy required to deliver this transition. So they're going really aggressively, which I think is the reason why they're demanding so much copper. In the global context, you know, we were talking about the US. We thought we were at peak interest rates. We thought that inflation was coming down. We thought that the Fed were going to cut their interest rates. That is looking likely it's going to be delayed, I think, because of stubbornly high interest rates. The employment rate in the US looks pretty good. So maybe we're not going to have quite as many cuts. I mean, it belies the fact that the copper price has been so strong in the face of that, but I think that will probably put a little bit of a hold on the copper price for a little while. But once those rate cuts start occurring in Europe, in the US, I think we're potentially going to see the much stronger uptick in copper price. So I had a view that I presented to our board that we were going to be seeing sort of high fours at the end of this year. I think maybe that extends into next year now, but certainly at some point in the next 12 to 18 months, I think we do reach all-time highs in copper. And then the question is, how long does it take for supply to respond? And I think that's at least a five-year time horizon that copper price is going to be very strong. And I think that's the window that we have to invest in Marimaca.
Really, really interesting perspective. I'm just wondering also in terms of, I mentioned earlier, you know, OEMs, battery manufacturers sort of moving upstream. Governments, US governments, we've spoken to a few North American focused CEOs. They feel that the US has woken up to this critical minerals list. It's not just a sort of casual thing. They are getting involved, not just in terms of, you know, IRA and various other kind of incentives, but positively making steps towards helping groups secure that metal supply coming down the line. Copper at the moment, it's always been a kind of base metal that you could get to, you know, traders and pick up. It's moving into that space, I think, where that supply demand fundamentals suggest that there's going to be some problems coming down the line. Are governments moving more quickly? Are you seeing them attending more conferences? Are they in more conversations, more of the dialogue? Or is that still not happening?
They definitely are for those commodities where China is completely dominant. They are moving remarkably quickly. For everything else, I think they're still the usual slow pedestrian governmental bureaucratic organizations. You know, you're absolutely right. I think one of the realizations that, for example, the US has had, and I think Robert Friedman talks about this regularly, is, you know, the grid there is old. The majority of the main transmission grid in the US is 1960s. It is not capable of delivering the amount of energy demand that will come if we all transition to electrics. Let's not even start into overlay the fact that, you know, there's a gigawatt of data center capacity being built pretty regularly in the US, which requires upgrade of the local infrastructure, transmission infrastructure, so that the grid doesn't go down. So you don't have what happened in Texas where the whole grid went down and, you know, people were without power here in the middle of a blizzard. You know, they're going to have to invest a lot of money in the transmission infrastructure. And they're definitely waking up to the fact that that's a government-led thing and it's going to require a lot of copper. So I think they are slowly waking up to it. I think they don't necessarily believe that copper's in as precarious situation as I think it is over the next 5 to 10 years while we wait for the supply to catch up. But certainly that window is going to be an interesting ride.
Yes, actually, funny enough, while you were saying that, it's like, would you believe they're definitely listening to us? I get an invite from to a conference in Washington, D.C. in the middle of June, being attended by speakers from the U.S. Senate, definitely paid for, Tesla, General Motors, etc. But also U.S. Department of Energy. So I guess that answers.
And also Maramaca. We are attending that conference.
And Maramaca, are you going?
Nico Cookson is doing the presentation for Maramaca, and he's already got a very full schedule.
That's my point. It's kind of like, you know, for the first time in a long time, companies are, you know, standing up on a stage in front of, you know, Department of Energy, Department of Defense in the U.S., because it's just got that little bit almost geopolitical out there. It's a small space, small sector, and, you know, perhaps people are just waking up again. It's not just about oil and gas.
It's been geopolitical for a while. Yeah, no, it's definitely there's a realization that China dominates a lot of fundamental commodities for a variety of applications, not least of which is military applications. And so there's a sudden realization that the long-term China strategy has really backed the West into a corner. Will that impact copper positively? Probably not as much as it would, you know, the more niche commodities, but certainly the whole commodities spectrum will benefit from it. The other challenge I think we're facing right now is there is a lot of geopolitical stuff going on, which obviously takes the wind out of the sails of people's willingness to take risk. You know, the specter of another war going on in the Middle East, the specter of China, you know, their ambitions in the South China Sea, all of that creates doubt, which I think causes capital to sit on the sideline. But, you know, in the fullness of time, as that sort of softens, you know, maybe we see that more aggressive transition of capital into the lower ends of the spectrum like us.
True. Okay. Well, why don't you say that? Reasons to believe. Why should people be investing in your company?
Well, so as we've just covered, copper is, in my view, one of the best setups that I've seen for a commodity. You know, I think the next 5 to 10 years is going to be a window where there will be pretty spectacular commodity price improvement. And there are very few new copper projects that are positioned to take advantage of transitioning from a developer into a producer during that window. We are one of those. But in terms of the risk spectrum of us being able to execute on those plans, we are about as well positioned as you're likely to find a copper producer, and we're putting our head down and going for it.
Okay. Well, great to speak to you as always. Stay in touch and, you know, try and talk to us more regularly, because I think it's one of the better, well, probably one of the best copper development stories out there. And I think people should be starting to pay attention as you kind of work your way through that Lassonde curve and up and over into the other side. Thanks again. Ciao.
Cheers.